WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture. Derek, Gary, and Lisa Nichols with you until 9 o'clock tonight. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. That's 855-915-WMFO. Spell it on your phone and you can talk to us. Coming up later tonight, a dramatic reading of the Donald Trump transcript that you are not going to want to miss.
We're exploring our thespian talents that we have here.
This is going to be good because even Lisa doesn't know everything that I have planned for this.
I know.
But let me tell you.
You and your surprises.
Yes, it's going to be fun. It's going to be exciting. We're going to be talking about that later tonight. Plus our favorite things from the past week, the strangest stories from the past week, everything that's going on. 28 days, Lisa. 28, 27.
The countdown is
27 long. Until it's over.
Again, I am just so incredibly happy that I'm going to be in Disney, the happiest place on earth, the week leading up to the election. So I will be completely away from all this nonsense.
Yeah. It just gets stupider and stupider. Donald Trump today said that ISIS is going to take over America if Hillary Clinton gets elected.
Good.
So,
happen.
Yeah. So we can look forward to
nothing
that
coming from
coming
him
next.
Is outlandish, as we will hear later on in the broadcast.
Boy, oh boy, oh boy! I can't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And the summer of blood was bad enough.
Yeah.
Now we have the autumn of our discontent.
Again, we can be angry though, considering that we have something to talk about every single week.
You know what? I honestly
would
miss...
you want to give that up? Would you want to start doing fluff stories?
Yes, if it means I don't have to talk about dead people or things coming out of Donald Trump's mouth every week.
Yeah.
Yes, I'll take that in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm. I think the worst part about this election is definitely the emphasis on social media and people that shouldn't be behind a computer screen are or behind their phones typing and texting away their thoughts on the presidential candidates and everything and anything about the election who just need to stop.
But I mean, even beyond that, there have been so many stories and we haven't talked about it. You know, I said more than a year ago that I believed that there were paid professionals out there manipulating the conversations on social media. There's been a bunch of stories that came out in the past week that basically said, yep, that's exactly what's going on. Hillary Clinton has had paid trolls going back to 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So she was a pioneer in the field.
Oh, at least she did something good.
Donald Trump's got his little army of trolls running around all over the place. And what it comes down to is you can't trust any of it. You can't trust any of
but since when,
any of these outlets
can you
are saying.
Trust a politician? You one would like to think that you would be able to, but this is just a whole new...
I'm a student of
so
history.
So you're getting all... you're just taking off on pieces of clothing.
I'm a student of history.
Angry.
I know better than to trust politicians. You're getting me worked up. We haven't even gotten into the news yet.
We're 3 minutes in?
Oh, for crying out loud. What's happening in the news?
Oh, well, today in local news, we learned which side of the ballot one local newspaper may be on. Staff at the Boston Globe worked with Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign to maximize her presence during her primary race against Senator Bernie Sanders. New emails show. The exchange is one of thousands from an inbox in Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta, leaked by the online group WikiLeaks over the past week. Marjorie Pritchard, the Globe's op-ed editor, contacted Podesta wondering if Clinton's campaign was still set to submit an op-ed. But then Pritchard went above and beyond and offered tips on how her campaign could extract maximum benefit from the place by coordinating its publication to match the Globe's regular reporting. Quote, it would be a good idea to get it in on Tuesday when she is in New Hampshire. That would give her a big presence on Tuesday with a piece on Wednesday with the news story. Please let me know now. Pritchard said in the exchange. Pritchard doesn't say what the forthcoming Wednesday article is, but the following Wednesday, the Globe ran a profile on Hillary Clinton's effort in New Hampshire titled Wanted More Hillary Clinton True Believers, end quote, along with another piece discussing Clinton's town hall appearance. So, you know, no surprise here. You know, this isn't the first time that the Globe really seems to involve itself into these sort of really deep into politics. You remember last April when they ran the fake 2017 cover
right.
of what it would be like if Donald Trump were to be president and how the world was going to end. And
listen, I think we all know that the Boston Globe is a left-leaning newspaper and has been a left-leaning newspaper for the duration of its existence. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you go back to the 1800s, you can find a time when it was not a left-leaning newspaper, but that's the Globe. It's always been the Globe leans left, the Herald leans right, and take your pick. What we're seeing in this email is a clear example of how the sausage is made. And we don't like to know how the sausage is made. What's disturbing about this is you have a newspaper whose editorial board has not endorsed a candidate behaving in a way that suggests they have endorsed a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem here. Because maybe the same overtures were made to Bernie Sanders. There is nothing to suggest that that happened. We don't have those emails. Bernie's accounts never got hacked.
But one could conclude that considering what all of her emails have showed, because we're not just talking about the Boston Globe, we're talking about multiple publications in multiple cities where there was trying to be some sort of coordinated effort to have maximum exposure from her camp that was placed in the newspaper.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all working together, and now we understand how her camp is making this all happen,
but here's
thanks to WikiLeaks.
But here's the thing, this goes on all the time.
No, absolutely. But to say, and it turns out that, you know, a mainstream media is in bed with a Democratic nominee.
Well, we knew that.
Come on. There's nothing shocking to that.
We knew that.
When the last time I was that shocked, I was in the shower and realizing that the water was wet. Like, that's nothing surprising.
What's surprising is the extent of it. Because this is just one example out of the emails, which the Clinton campaign has tried to claim were doctored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Podesta comes out and he said, oh, no, they changed the content of the emails. Yeah. No, they didn't, John. No, by the way, the American people are not buying that excuse.
Mm-hmm.
We're not falling for that one. The Russians have no idea how to doctor these emails.
No, and that's everything that's coming out of Clinton's camp right now. They're just, they're yelling Watergate, Russia,
and
all those buzzwords.
It's not Watergate. Nobody paid the Russians to break in. They did it of their own volition, and they did it. Why? Because Vladimir Putin hates Hillary Clinton. Vladimir Putin hates Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton and the State Department backed a coup against Vladimir Putin in the spring of 2011. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
He does not want Hillary Clinton to be president. He has a personal grudge against her. So that's how we get to the Russian involvement in this. But what gets surprising is how far reaching this is. In addition to the Boston Globe finding ways to give her extra coverage, you have the New York Times writing a piece about Hillary Clinton and then giving her campaign,
which basically should just be renamed Hillary Clinton paper.
And then giving Hillary Clinton's campaign the right to delete any quotes that they wanted.
It's basically saying,
you can remove these quotes.
This is all of the information. This is the stories that we are going to put out. Here, can you look over them? Make sure they're good. You know, fluff them up a little, doctor them, send them back. So basically the New York Times, Boston Globe, their new editor is Hillary Clinton.
That is 100% a no-go in a newsroom. You never give the subject access to the piece or the ability to shape the piece. You don't.
Well, you and I, both, you know, students of journalism in college that have very high respect for the art form, it's so much different now. And you see this and hear this because we're not talking about on a level of, hey, we're going to give you coverage on a certain day. It is a coordinated effort.
Yes.
It's like a song and dance on when we're going to put this, where, when, and what we're going
to
put in.
To me, the most damning revelation that came out of these hacked emails was finding out that CNN's Donna Brazile handed one of the questions for a CNN town hall with the candidates last March to the Clinton campaign.
So you wonder when...
Gave her the question.
Everybody says that Clinton seems so rehearsed. It's because she is.
Yeah.
She's getting all the questions firsthand.
Yeah, she's getting the questions in advance. She's getting the ability to edit what she says in the media. This is a complete failure of our media, top to bottom.
But it is, and you know when you say the media is in bed, literally they're in bed. Just looking at some of the ABC News executive producer Ian Cameron, married to Susan Rice, Obama's national security advisor, CBS president David Rhodes, brother Ben Rhodes, Obama's deputy national security advisor for strategic communication, ABC News correspondent Claire Shipman, married to former White House press secretary Jay Carney.
Yep.
Everybody is working with each other.
Yeah.
So when you say there's a separation between the news media that is actually supposed to put out the information to the people.
Not anymore.
That is unbiased.
Not anymore. Not anymore. The bias.
You are failing your readers. You are failing America. How is the average person reading a newspaper, reading an article from their phone, supposed to get actual news?
The bias is thick and rich and creamy. That's where it is right now. The bias is thick and rich and creamy. And I'll tell you where you go to get news. Come on over here.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are not layering any personal bias. Well, Lisa does because she's a crazy gun lady. I am not layering any personal bias. We try and hit everything right down the middle. And if we're completely out of line on something, we rely on our callers to call in and let us know we're out of our minds. And our callers do that. You know, I still take that responsibility seriously. I still take my presence behind this microphone as an obligation to the people who tune into this show and listen to it every week to give you the facts, the unvarnished truth about what's going on out there. Do we have fun with the stories sometimes? Sure. Do we take a position on things sometimes? Occasionally we do. Certainly, you know, I do on some of the contentious issues. We try and present solutions to get you to think. We don't tell you how you should think. But that's exactly what all of these other organizations are doing. Clinton News Network, Nobody But Clinton, Make Sure Nobody Beats Clinton, All About Clinton.
And if there was any speculation before
Clinton
this,
Broadcast Service,
you know, though, coming post primaries, when you were hearing rumors of this going on, especially, you know, people that were for the Trump or Sanders campaign, this is actual proof. This is proof that it happens.
Yeah.
And as you said, we don't know if there was some sort of effort from whether it be the Boston Globe, New York Times, Washington Post, that was making contacts with the Sanders campaign. I'm going to look in your crystal ball that you tend to look in and say, look at back in time, that didn't happen. It's clear what the intentions were. And this is where it got us.
The fix was in from day one. Mm-hmm. And it was painfully obvious to some of us that the fix was in from day one. Here's reality. Here's where I bust out the crystal ball for a second. None of this is doing Hillary Clinton any favors. Everything going on with Donald Trump is not helping Hillary Clinton because Trump voters are not jumping ship to Clinton. My feeling is that all of these revelations that are coming out on both sides now at this point serve only one purpose, and that is to depress voter turnout. That we are going to see, and I may have said this last week as well.
I'd be so incredibly disgusted.
I think we are going to see
the election.
Lower voter turnout now for this race than we saw in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be profoundly disappointing in a presidential race. But I'm adding a second prediction to this. Hillary Clinton is going to win with less than 50% of the American people supporting her, which means she is going to enter office as a wounded and rudderless president. She is not going to have the authority of the people to enact anything at all. And if the Republicans can hold on to their majorities in the House and the Senate, House is probably a little safer than the Senate is right now on that front. We are going to have two more years of total and complete gridlock and nothing getting done.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, though, we will get rid of President Barack Obama and his misadventures in foreign policy. Which would be a plus.
Name of his autobiography.
We tell you to watch Frontline on this show all the time. This week's Frontline, once again, is a must watch because it talks precisely about how the Obama administration's plan to train Syrians to go over and fight ISIS failed completely.
Mm-hmm.
And goes into very great detail about everything that the Obama administration did wrong that allowed this crisis to become what it is.
And how much that has catapulted what is going on right now in the Middle East.
Not just in the Middle East, in Europe. Mm-hmm. I mean, the effects of our inaction, and I said quite a while
ago. That's true. I mean, it's talking about, with what is going on in Syria, then the influx of migrants moving into Europe, but not only Europe, mostly Europe, but here especially too in the United States. But just like coming back to this and bringing up the emails with the media. As an American citizen, as somebody that is an avid reader of media, newspapers, regardless if it's online or actual print, it really disheartens me. And it makes me think, I deserve to be able to read something that is unbiased, to know that there isn't some back workings with the election.
Right. Well,
with either candidate.
Well, this is where I refer you to Derek's first rule of the news. Always look at multiple sources. Never get your news from a single source. Look at what Fox is saying. Look at what Huffington Post is saying. Look at what Reuters is saying. Look at what AP is saying. Look at as many different sources for a single story as you can. Because when you start looking at all of the different sources, you get a sense of who is biased in which way.
Mm-hmm.
And the facts...
And it's pretty clear.
And the facts tend to separate themselves from the bias when you soak in enough of this stuff. That's how you become an intelligent news consumer. That's the only thing that you can do in this environment. By the way, Derek's second rule of consuming the news, never, ever, ever trust a source without first finding out who the heck they are. You do those two things, and you're going to be smarter than most of the people reading something on Instagram and then chirping about it on Facebook.
It's true.
And you may be able to make better decisions than those people. I suggest you not invite those people to the shelter you should be building in your backyard right now. Maybe it's not that bad. In world or national news, Houthi rebels in Yemen fired upon the USS Mason for a second time today. The Mason fired defensive shots at the missiles, neither of which hit the Navy destroyer or the nearby USS Ponce. Both ships came under fire from shore-to-ship missiles on Sunday. The Pentagon is under pressure to respond to these missile attacks, and an attack on a United Arab Emirates. It's never easy. And an attack on a United Arab Emirates vessel that took place on October 1st. If the United States retaliates, this would mark the military's first involvement in the war against Iranian-backed Houthi rebels, who have also been targeted by Saudi Arabia. One thing that Frontline last night went into some depth about is the split between Saudi Arabia and the United States, which has not been widely publicized on these shores. But the Saudis basically told the Americans to get bent a little over a year ago, thanked us for the billions of dollars in tanks and warplanes and advanced missile systems that we gave them, and set off to go deal with the Houthis and potentially Iran in their own way.
No, I mean, but the Saudi campaign, it's largely failed to stop the Houthis so far. Instead, much of Yemen, you're seeing this country on the brink of famine. There's reports of civilians killed by airstrikes pretty much every other day that are by the Saudi-led coalitions. And this is becoming so routine. So just this past Saturday, nearly 140 people were killed, more than 600 were wounded in the airstrike. That was one of the deadliest since Saudi Arabia and its allies began the air campaign in March. Or 2015, so March of last year. But if you're going to start shooting at U.S. ships, at what?
You're more or less begging for retaliation.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. Here's the Houthis are involved in a rebellion against a government in Yemen that the United States recognizes. The Houthis are Shiites, Saudi Arabians. Am I right about this? The Saudis are Shiites, and they
took over the capital.
The Saudi Arabians are Sunnis. The Iranians are Shiites. What all of this, in a way, comes back to is the United States nuclear deal with Iran, which has upset the balance of power in that part of the world. because for the last several decades, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East has basically been, we're going to back the Sunnis, who are our friends, against the Shiites, mm-hmm. who are our enemies. This played into the Iraq War and a number of other things that have gone on over there.
We've always had Saudi Arabia as one of our allies.
The nuclear deal with Iran, as I have said in the past, was a good idea. It's not the best deal. It gets us a seat at the table. Iran has been thumbing their nose at us ever since we signed the deal. And their support of the Houthis is another way of thumbing their nose at us. That rebels that they have financed, armed, and backed are shooting at American Navy vessels is a very, very bad thing. And that Iranian nuclear deal should be off the table right now. This is what America could do diplomatically. They could basically say, deal's off, give us our billions of dollars mm-hmm. back that we gave you for the hostages, even though it wasn't a ransom. And we see you go anywhere near anything nuclear, we're sending in the drones. Okay, that's one way that we could deal with this diplomatically. Iran is basically going to say, thumb their nose at us again. If we get involved in the middle of this, which we really don't want to do, it now becomes the United States and Saudi Arabia against Iran. And this is a proxy war that Iran would love to stir up.
But again, I feel like you've said that so many times. This is something that we don't want to get involved in. And there's so many connections because we're not just talking about one country against the other. As you just said, we're with Saudi, but Saudi is against Iran, but we're also with Iran.
And the Saudis aren't worth us. And by the way, another thing that came out in those Hillary Clinton emails is they had proof that the Saudis were financing ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which is a little bizarre, except that you think, well, you know, it is a bunch of Sunnis trying to kill a bunch of Shia. Really, what the rest of the world ought to do is hire Donald Trump, put a big wall around the whole thing, okay, so nobody can get out, let the Sunnis and the Shias kill each other until one side is left standing or everybody gets sick of it, and then we can move back in and rebuild. We do not want to be in the middle of this, because this is a holy war as far as the Saudis and the Iranians are concerned.
Decades old.
This is about influence. Mm-hmm. This is about who controls Mecca. It doesn't get any bigger than that. It does not get any bigger than that in that religion. And I'm not saying Muslims are warlike. I'm not saying it's a hostile religion. I'm saying there is a religious schism at the heart of this whole thing.
But again, we've seen for decades this war with religion over this area. Is this something that's ever going to change?
Yeah.
When you have so many groups that are claiming land and claiming, you know.
As long as Iran was basically cut off from the rest of the world and we were supporting the Saudis, there was a level of balance over there
mm-hmm.
because there wasn't anything that Iran could do. Well, not only did we bring Iran back into the rest of the world, we gave them several billion dollars. They immediately took that several billion dollars and gave it to the Houthis, who are now using it to fire missiles at the American Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, somebody...
It's an interesting chain of events.
Somebody in the State Department or one of our think tanks should have seen this coming, you would think.
Mm.
Somebody somewhere might have said, you know, maybe empowering Iran in the current environment, not the best idea.
So then how can you say this was a good deal? Other than your claim of saying this is going to get us a seat at the table. And I had brought this up to you before. Is that enough? Is getting us a seat at the table enough justification for all of this that's happening?
It actually got us two things. If you trust the Iranians... It got us a seat at the table. And
trust in Iranians? Is that in the same
yes.
sentence?
If you trust the Iranians, I don't believe that the Iranians are inherently untrustworthy. I don't believe that anyone is inherently untrustworthy, except car salesmen and people who approach you with a great deal in Vegas. Those people are inherently trustworthy. Nations are not inherently trustworthy. It got you a seat at the table, and it also got, at the very least, a delay to the Iranian nuclear program. Because this was the other way that this thing goes. We keep talking about sanctions and all the rest of this. Iran develops a nuclear weapon, and now you have a nuclear Iran seeking to project power in the Middle East. Where are they going to use that? Well, they're either going to drop it on Israel or they're going to drop it on Saudi Arabia. And either one of those actions immediately triggers World War III. So you have delayed World War III at the expense of widening a sectarian conflict in a part of the world that already has more than enough sectarian conflict going on.
So what do you think the ending result of this is going to be? I mean, are we going to be seeing more attacks on U.S. warships? When does it stop? What's that line in the sand?
I would imagine that we have...
Before action is starting to be...
I would imagine that the Pentagon has a plan in place to take out the people who are firing the missiles, and probably the missiles as well. And we will hear about that action being completed before the end of this weekend.
Now, do we start getting into a conversation where we have either, well, we don't really care about Yemen, but we have the Houthis, which are going to Iran. Now Iran is pissed at us. I mean, it's just this cycle.
That's, you can...
But really, what can they do?
You can make a case against it, because...
Because they're not going to drop the deal. They're benefiting from it.
If the Iranians come back and they say, hey, you killed our Houthis, the United States can say, your Houthis were shooting at our warships.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to put up with that. Okay, there are limits to the amount of crap that we're going to take from you, Iran. Would you like the nuclear deal to be dissolved? And we do have that one thing to hold over them. So I think we're going to see a very limited use of U.S. power in Yemen to get rid of the Houthis. Maybe, or at least the Houthis who are firing the missiles. Because, I mean, these people are just stupid. That's just stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Don't shoot at the United States. Everybody else on the planet gets that.
It's the same thing
missiles.
A few months ago when, where was it? When our soldiers were taken hostage for a couple hours in the Middle, not a couple hours, but a couple days in the Middle East. And we were saying that, you know, there should be a call from Washington over to, was that Iran?
Yeah.
They took over one of our ships that happened to go in Iranian waters.
But that was a screw-up on our part. And that was a big screw-up on our part.
But again, it's this relationship that we supposedly is good right now with Iran, when Iran is, and I've said it before, they're really sitting on the back seat. They're benefiting from this deal. They're playing both sides.
Oh, of course.
And they have us held in the palm of their hand.
But they don't quite. They don't quite, because we can always pull the deal. And they
know
that.
Well, at least in this administration we have, because you know Obama would never, ever do anything. He never has done anything.
He's at a point right now where you can't have somebody firing missiles at a U.S. destroyer and not retaliate.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it. Especially if they had done it once. All right, maybe, you know, hey, somebody screwed up. All right, we're gonna forgive that. Now they've done it twice, okay? We need to take action. We need to take action within the next 96 hours.
Only so many times you can poke the bear.
Pentagon gets that. President Barack Obama gets that. Everybody gets that. Everybody should expect that this is coming. This is going to happen. It doesn't necessarily mean an end to the agreement with Iran, because Iran's going to sit back and say, well, you know, hey, it's not us. That's the Houthis. Mm-hmm. We don't know what they're doing. We just gave them some money.
No, a question I pose to you, you know, if Clinton gets into the presidency, nothing's going to change with this.
No.
But
when I said nothing was going to change, I meant domestically.
No, I'm talking about the Iranian deal.
Foreign policy, get ready for war. Get ready for war on every front, because Hillary Clinton cannot wait
You think she would dissolve the Iranian deal?
I don't know that she'd dissolve the Iranian deal.
Because
but I
feel like Trump would do it much quicker than she would even think about it.
I actually think Donald Trump would be less likely to dissolve the Iranian deal than Hillary Clinton would be.
Then why is he touting himself so much on saying, you know, this is a bad deal, we should drop it?
Because it is a bad deal. Everybody who's looked at it knows it's a bad deal.
Of course it
okay?
is. We shipped billions of dollars. I'm sorry, we flew over
pallets
billions
full of money.
Of
pallets
dollars
of money
in cash.
On a plane, pallets of money.
Wasn't some gold kind of wrapped in there too?
No, they had to get Swiss francs and euros and anything that was laying at hand, because they didn't have the cash sitting around. Pallets full of money flew into Iran and then flew over to the Houthis, apparently, which they used to buy missiles that they could shoot at our destroyer. Hey, great job, everybody. Nicely done. That's foreign policy for you. But we can't get deeply involved in this thing. Ultimately, we've got to leave it to Saudi Arabia and Iran to figure out, because they're the two big dogs over there. Iran is the biggest Sunni dominant country in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, the capital of the Muslim world, because mm-hmm. they've got Mecca. Everybody looks to them. You know, moderate countries like Jordan and Turkey aren't going to get in the middle of this unless people start shooting at them.
No, and there's no reason for us to get involved, especially with a proxy war, because you have to ask whenever there is some sort of conflict, what is our role in it?
Except
what do we do? Except when we get pushed too far, then you get involved.
When they start shooting at us, yes. we have to get involved. And at the same time, we need to get our ships out of there so that they can't shoot at us again. Because if one of those missiles hits and American lives are lost, any hope of a diplomatic solution to this thing goes out the door mm-hmm. in a wave of public pressure. If that happens at this point, this is my read on the whole thing. If that happens at this point, after two failed attacks, the American people are going to be sitting there going, what the hell are you doing? Why did you leave our ship in harm's way? How are you going to respond to this? Why did we make a deal with Iran in the first place? So in the hope of saving, you know, whatever progress has been made, we get those ships out of there. Shouldn't be the way it is, but, you know, nobody thought the Houthis were that dumb. Bad move, Houthis. Love saying that word, Houthis. In world news, Russian Duma member Vladimir Zhirinovsky warned U.S. voters that a vote for Hillary Clinton is a vote for nuclear war. In an interview, Zhirinovsky said, quote, if they vote for Hillary, it's war. It will be a short movie. There will be Hiroshimas and Nagasakis everywhere, end quote. Zhirinovsky is considered a flamboyant outlier in Russian national politics, but he is rumored to be a mouthpiece for provocative comments from Russia's government. His comments come a day after White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said the United States was considering, quote, proportional responses to alleged hacking of voting machines and the email accounts of Democrats by Russian agents.
Russia's back.
It will be a short movie. There will be Hiroshimas and Nagasakis yeah. everywhere.
That's nice.
Everywhere.
What, are we just going to go for complete devastation?
Yeah. You know.
I think this is a lot of boastful talking. And of course, again, as you just stated in the beginning of the show, Russia does not like Clinton for many reasons. Will this happen? No. I think that's a little too far, and I think this man is kind of just sharing his words.
You know, normally I would say this is a lot of noise coming from somebody who is a known agitator in the Russian government. I mean, it's sort of just Zhirinovsky's role. You know?
Or unless his prediction is more looking at what, as you, again, you just said, Clinton's foreign policy will be and what a disaster it will be and how many conflicts she will get us involved in.
All of the things that Vladimir Putin has done in the last couple of years have made him incredibly popular with the Russian people. The Russian people love him. Even though their economy is going to crap, they love Putin. They love the government. They love the aggressiveness. They love all of this. So on the one hand, getting Zhirinovsky out here to say this is just a way of ratcheting up the rhetoric.
Of course.
There isn't necessarily anything behind it. On the other hand, he has in the past been used as a mouthpiece for the Kremlin to mm-hmm. say things that they don't know if they necessarily want to say.
Well, again, I think a lot of messages that are coming from the Kremlin, and whether they're using him as a voice for it, they know that American media is going to pick it up. So they're going to run with that quote leading on the story. And whether that garners fear from Americans for the upcoming election, that strays people away from voting for Hillary Clinton and moving over to Donald Trump, or whether it just takes them completely out of voting.
Do I want to panic about this comment? No. Should people be worried about this comment? No. Is Russia going to drop the bombs because we elect Hillary Clinton? No. But this is Russia very clearly saying, we're not working with Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
We will not work with her. We don't like her.
Well, that's what you have to look at this.
Vladimir Putin doesn't mm-hmm. like her. And Vladimir Putin has proven himself to be a very adept student of the right move at the right time so far. And this is the latest in sort of an escalating conflict between the United States and Russia. We saw Russia walk away from the nuclear disarmament deal last week. There was a report that came out in Russian state media today that the wealthy elites of Russia have been ordered to bring their children back from Western schools. And the rationale behind it, according to Western observers, is that they don't want the elites to be seen cozying up to the Western world at the same time that Putin is telling everybody else in Russia, hey, the West is our enemy, they're decadent, they're horrible. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of entrenchment going on and a circling of the wagons that we haven't seen. Gorbachev actually came out and said, listen, everybody needs to calm down and start talking to each other. So he's concerned about this because, in a certain sense, he's watching his legacy go up in flames right now.
I think if we were to take this a couple years ago and the role that Russia had and Putin and where his stance was on the global aspect, I feel in the past couple years, and especially in this past year, he has been catapulted to that big figure. I mean, look at the actions that
he was there long before that.
No, but really on the forefront of what's going on with ISIS, what's going on in Libya, what's going on Syria as a whole, but especially in the Middle East. And he has taken on that role that really the United States has held on to for so many years. Whether that's a world power to, you know, monitor the actions of different countries. And I feel like the United States has really taken a backseat to
it. We have, because Obama's plan has been
because of this administration
to do nothing. Lead from behind. That was the policy. We remember the pivot to Russia?
I've asked you so many times, what was the point where the United States got to that point where we were this world leader, and if you called us the world police, but we've taken a step back and kind of been behind everybody on action.
Well, you had one president that squandered all of our global credibility on a war with Iraq that we never should have gotten involved in, mm-hmm. because he saw an opportunity. And you have another president who has basically retreated entirely from projecting power in the global community.
Because again, we're not talking about the United States, a country that isn't involved in any of this. We're involved in every single thing. But again, you know, Obama had made that line in the sand and said, oh, you can't cross it. And how many times people have pushed and pushed and pushed, yeah. and we still sit back and do nothing? How many people have died because of that?
Well, this is where these missile attacks on the USS Mason become a problem. Because, again, if you fire a bunch of missiles over a couple of days at U.S. ships and we don't do anything, there goes some more of our credibility mm-hmm. in the international community.
Oh, you can shoot at them and nothing's going to happen.
We've already got allies, including Saudi Arabia, who feel that we won't defend them. Now, if it looks like you won't defend your own military,
who's going to stand with us?
Who's going to stand with us? Nobody. Who's going to support us? Nobody.
How many times have we brought up a story and talking about, would we have defense from any of these countries in Europe? Would Germany step forward? Would England step forward? Would France step forward? No, probably not.
Probably not. Not at this point. No. My favorite Russian quote for today was from Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. I was talking to CNN's Christine Amanpour. She asked him about the comments on Donald Trump's video. And Lavrov had this to say, quote, English is not my mother tongue. I don't know that I would sound decent. There are so many pussies around your presidential campaign on both sides that I prefer not to comment about this. Go, Foreign Minister Lavrov.
Well, today in sports, we learn Italy says ciao to the Olympics. The Italian National Olympic Committee has suspended Rome's bid for the 2024 Games, though it has left open the possibility for a revival of candidacy if there is a change in the city's government. The committee's president, Giovanni Malago, said he wrote a letter to the International Olympic Committee on Tuesday to interrupt the candidacy. The move follows a vote by Rome City Council last month to withdraw support on one of the biggest recommendations from Mayor Virginia Raggi. The city's withdrawal would leave Los Angeles, Paris, and Budapest in the running for the Games. The IOC will select a host city in September 2017. It will also mark the second time in 4 years that Rome has withdrawn or interrupted. In 2012, the Prime Minister Mario Monti scrapped the city's bid for the 2020 Olympics because of financial concerns. Raggi, who represents the anti-establishment five-star movement, said taking on the cost of the Olympic bid was, quote, irresponsible for the city struggling to emerge from years of corruption and poor public services. Though Raggi wrote a letter to the IOC last month, the IOC rules state that the National Olympic Committee can withdraw candidacy. Quote, anybody can write to the IOC, but the letter that counts is the one from the president of the Olympic Committee, Milago said. So again, we have another city that is realizing the cost of the Olympics. Boston, thank you again for backing out of the 2024 Olympics. But this, again, and it's really interesting, the conversations that have been going on between, again, this is Rome's first female mayor, this Virginia Raggi, and the Milago, who's the head of the national committee for the Olympics. And they're kind of comparing it to Vancouver and saying, look what that left him. When they backed out of the Olympics that were given to Lake Placid, they didn't get it for another 30 years. Rome's going to be in that situation where in Italy, they may not see an Olympics for 30, 40 years. This whole scheme has really changed when we're talking about Olympics that were in the 1970s to when they are now. We are also just came off of hearing that what we're over $30 billion past the cost in Tokyo. So that's four times the initial estimate. Yeah.
Montreal just paid off its debt from the 1976 Olympics. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago. These countries can't afford it. Mm-hmm. It is no longer viable. And when, look, everybody talks about climate change. Everybody talks about sustainability. What is sustainable about building these monuments to a two-week event all over the freaking planet?
Mm-hmm. No, and this interruption, you know, of the bid, it's just another signal that the IOC is based, not only is it failing to convince or bamboozle all these cities in believing that they actually could pay for it, but people are becoming smarter. There's more people that from the country, people that pay taxes, that are coming forward and saying, we don't want this. So you just saw in Rome. It happened, what, a couple years ago out in Denver. They said, no, we don't want it.
I have been saying since, I believe, 2014. Somewhere,
yeah, a few years we've been
somewhere
saying.
Somewhere around there. We need permanent Olympic venues. Mm-hmm. Okay? Pick a country. I think it should be Greece. Greece has all the Olympic facilities. They're there. You can use them for whatever you want when there's no Olympic Games going on. You can hold, you know, the qualifiers there. You can have the World Finals there. You can have soccer matches there. You can do all kinds of things with them. And then every 4 years, you pick a different host country to come in, and they control that area for those 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So that you get all the flavor of Britain, or you get all the flavor of Bahrain, or whatever country wants to be that Olympic sponsor. They get to decide how everything's going to look. They get to decide, you know, everything that you would normally do if you were hosting the Olympic Games, only you have all of these ready-made facilities. So you're basically just slapping a fresh coat of paint on it.
Because mm-hmm. We're seeing, though, so much is these countries that are taking on this burden in these individual cities, and we're left with billions of dollars in debt.
So set up a permanent venue in Lillehammer, set up a permanent venue in Greece, and then let the cost of that, hosting those games, rotate around to different countries every 4 years. Still go through the bid process, still have everything the way it is now, only everybody's going to the same place. Mm-hmm. And you can actually build permanent infrastructure that will not be disruptive, that will accommodate people coming and going. Imagine you got an airport right next to the Olympic venues.
But the IOC,
you get off the plane, you get on a bus, and boom, you're at your hotel.
The IOC still pushes this magical fantasy that it brings so much into the cities.
Yes,
maybe it was decades ago, but it isn't anymore. And saying that it brings millions and billions of dollars into the area, no, it doesn't. Not only does it leave a city with the financial burden, but it really doesn't have that much of an impact on the surrounding area.
As we have seen from the allegations made in the last few years, allegedly, IOC members are getting filthy, rotten rich off of bribes and kickbacks associated with this bidding process. They are the problem. And what it is going to take is all of these countries around the world saying, we're not going to do this anymore.
Well, look at here, just on a local level, how much coverage we put on Boston 2024. And not only just from the start of it and the initial upbringing of it, but talking about each week we were finding out more and more corruption that was going on just in the bid for it.
Sure.
We didn't even get it.
It's a scoundrel's dream. Because the venues only have to stay up for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
They can all fall down after that.
I could never imagine if we ever had it here. Just the amount of people. And talking about IOC getting rich, it's all local people, local corporations, local governments that are getting rich off of it.
Well,
look what happened just in Rio.
I know.
Nobody wanted that.
I know exactly what's going to happen. $1 billion disappeared during the big dig. $1 billion. Disappeared. Nobody knows where it went. It just vanished.
Mm-hmm.
And Congress threatened to cut off funding for the project before it was finished because of that. Now, do I need to tell you what's going to happen if the Olympics come to town?
Well, in food news, we learn efforts to save one of the world's most prized foods has begun. A campaign has been launched in Italy to save the forest that produces the world's most prized culinary treasures, the white truffle. The fungi in the woods of the northern region of Piedmont, in a particular area of rolling countryside known as Lang, around the town of Elba. Truffle hunters are concerned that woodland is being dug up and replaced with vineyards and hazelnut groves, the region that produces large quantities of nuts for Nutella, the chocolate spread that was invented in the city. They also worry that the woods are no longer being grazed by domestic animals such as pigs and goats, in which in the past kept the undergrowth under control and made access to the rich, damp soil easier for the truffle dogs and their owners. A campaign has been launched to raise 50,000 euros to preserve six district truffle hunting areas. It is being led by Carlo Miranda, a project manager who hunts truffles in his spare time. White ripe truffles of the area are among the world's most expensive, sought after by chefs and gourmets around the world. In 2014, the largest truffle, weighing over 4 pounds, was sold by Sotheby's in New York for $61,000. While white truffles of Piedmont are particularly prized, white truffles are found in most parts of the country, with Umbria accounting for 30% of total production. So this is a really interesting story.
No,
that I
it's
found
not.
No,
no, it's
it
not.
Is.
You know what? The 99% say we want our Nutella. We want our Nutella. You rich people and your truffles can go get bent, okay? We plant the hazelnuts. And if the truffles happen to grow on the hazelnut trees, you win.
No, what's interesting about this and what I first
what's interesting about this is
it,
rich people are upset.
No, it's the fact that we have a company like Nutella that is taking over these areas that should be reserved for, if we're talking about only one area in the entire globe can grow a certain product, it's the same thing of like saying an endangered species. You're going to preserve that area so you have it. So,
an endangered species that happens to sell for $15,000 a pound.
It's not rich people being angry.
Yes, it's rich people being angry. Do you see a lot of the poor eating truffles?
No.
Okay. Do you see a lot of the poor eating Nutella? Yes,
no,
you do.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do. What? How do we make the land do the most good for the greatest number of people? We grow more Nutella.
No, but if we talk about something that is so limited and rare, why can't we have reserved areas for it? Whether it just be a small acre for it or a couple acres.
That's fine. You get
but
an acre.
Just,
surrounded
it's
by
major
Nutella.
Major corporation coming in and taking over this area.
Yeah, because they're growing hazelnuts. What's wrong with hazelnuts? Who doesn't want a hazelnut forest?
Yeah, but where you can grow hazelnuts, you can grow that anywhere. Or many other places.
Yeah, but they want to grow it there. Maybe there's no place else. Maybe there is no other room for the amount of hazelnuts that they need.
So you have the options to grow something else somewhere else, but this one thing can only grow.
Look, really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're not talking about an endangered flower. We're talking about fungus. Generally speaking, the human race doesn't feel too kindly toward fungi or slime molds. They're two things that we're just not going to go out of our way to save. Okay? They're not cute. A lot of them are poisonous and dangerous, and we don't want them around.
And a lot of them are delicious.
Yeah, well, this one happens to be delicious, and, you know, oh, my God, the horror of the horror. Mm-hmm. The rich people might not have their truffles.
What was that a few months ago when you were in New York, and you were telling me about this dish you had, and they shaved truffles.
Yeah.
And you were saying how it was, one of the most greatest culinary experiences.
Yeah.
And you just kept repeating.
That was black truffle, by the way.
But again, we're talking about, we're on the same thing.
Because
and how you were being fancy.
I believe the
and enjoying the truffles.
I believe the black truffle shavings were $70 and the white truffle shavings were $150. So we were not getting
so
the white truffle.
So you still enjoyed finer things.
I'm not saying I don't like truffles, okay? I'm saying that if we're talking about preserving a forest so that some rich people can have their $15,000 a pound mushroom versus planting hazelnut trees are going to feed hundreds of thousands of people Nutella. I'm on the side of the Nutella.
Yeah, but we're not talking about millions of acres. That we're talking about this small area that they're trying to preserve. This one last thing that's a part of culinary.
Fine, build a warehouse around it and grow them indoors.
There you go. This is why he's trying to raise this money.
That's fine. You can have your one little plot of truffle land, and then let's get some more Nutella growing around that. Honestly, come on. You don't think I'm going to take the side of the rich on this thing? You know me better than that. It's WMFO Medford. I'm supposed to say that.
I'm going to find you some white truffles and feed them to you.
Listen, if you're paying, I'll eat white truffles all day long.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll get you some white truffle oil.
If you're buying, no, I don't want the oil. I want shaved white truffles.
It's about expensive okay. It's going to get for you.
Yeah, no. What did I get you for your birthday, by the way? Did I get you 30-year-old port when you turned 30?
Mm-hmm.
Nice co-host. In technology news, the Pentagon is scrambling to counter the newest threat from ISIS drones. Last week, two Kurdish fighters were killed in an explosion when they tried to dismantle a small ISIS drone that contained a bomb made to look like a battery. U.S. military analysts say that ISIS is continually improving improvised explosive devices attached to a range of off-the-shelf drones, including one that destroyed buildings at a military checkpoint last week. The Pentagon has requested $20 million from Congress to find ways to stop ISIS drones, which they now consider remotely piloted bombs. Take a drone, strap a bomb to the front of it.
Sounds pretty easy.
Fly the drone at the enemy. Enemy goes boom.
Mm-hmm.
These are the same people who brought us the improvised explosive devices during the Iraq War. And the solution that we found to that was, for a little while at least, getting off-the-shelf remote controls for kids' remote control cars. And they turned one of those things on in the front of every Hummer, and the bombs would blow up before they got to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, think about how easily it is to access a drone nowadays. I mean, you can order them online, you can go to the store and get them. And the damage that could be done, depending on how big the explosive is that you attach to it. But essentially what you have is you have a mobile transport for it where you have a camera to get an exact location on where you want to drop said bomb. Or we're gone from the days of having to strap yourself with something. Look at what happened in Paris when they went to the stadium. You had people that were sacrificing themselves for jihad that were strapping bombs and blowing up people. We're now in a situation where you can take drones, fly them over, use your little camera on the drones, and drop them wherever you want.
Apparently,
whether you drop them or land them.
Apparently, one of the threats against the Rio Olympics was that they were going to do this. They were going to put little bombs and drones and fly them at the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this isn't just an issue in the war. Because this is the sort of thing that Dabiq magazine or Inspire magazine publishes in their next online issue. And then every little jihadi wannabe running around the United States is rushing out to buy a drone and strap a pressure cooker to it. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, the one good thing in all of this is that the off-the-shelf drones can't carry a lot. So you can't put a really big bomb on them. But you can put a big enough bomb on them to kill a couple people, or to do some damage, or to scare the heck out of people, which is really what ISIS is all about. You know, they are the clown in the woods.
If we look at recent attacks and everything that's been coming out from ISIS, they don't care if it's on a mass scale.
Yeah.
If it's one, two, three here and there, they're still doing what they're intended to do. It's not only killing people, but injuring people, but putting fear. This is just one other thing. And I think you posted on the Facebook wall, this is something that keeps the Pentagon up at night.
Yeah.
And it is. It's true.
Here's by the way, you can give me the $20 million Pentagon. You force every manufacturer in the world to operate their drones on a select narrow band of radio frequencies. Then you can simply block those frequencies and stop the drones from being controlled. That would not stop a sophisticated enemy from reconfiguring it, but it would stop the vast majority of drones. This is probably what they're going to do, by the way, is they'll probably figure out what the most common frequencies are and then figure out a way to jam them. But over time...
Just so nobody can use drones?
Over time, no, well, selectively.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, around the football stadium, you turn on the jammer, nobody can get a drone in.
So it's an invisible wall.
Right. They all stop working at the edge of the parking lot. Mm-hmm. Nobody can get a drone closer than that. And then if... But that's...
Or you're going to have to, because we live in a time, though, where there really is no restrictions on drones. There's very few.
It's going to take a little time, and you got to get the Chinese on board, but you can force manufacturers to do that, because it is a radio-emitting device, and you need unobscured radio communications to get the thing to work. So everybody's off in their own little specific bits of bandwidth with this. So if you just narrow it, lock it in on that very narrow range, of course, you reserve different bandwidth for the military stuff and the police stuff. But you can stop a lot of this fairly simply with a little bit of time.
There's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather.
Your Boston 5-day forecast. Hey, good nights to cozy up with someone you love. Right?
Mm.
That's what this time of year is good for. Sweaters and cozying up with someone you love. Temperature has fallen down into the low 50s downtown. Look out for some 30s in those upper 30s in those really, really cool spots here on the Commonwealth. Some showers move in tomorrow morning. High during the day, about 70 degrees. We fall back into the mid-40s tomorrow night. Then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, all pretty much the same thing. Gorgeous, perfect fall weather. Not a cloud in the sky, no real chance for rain until very late on Sunday. Highs in the mid-50s, lows in the 40s. Friday and Saturday, we'll be going down into the 30s in those cooler suburbs. And then Sunday night, lows in the low 50s. Monday, partly cloudy day, a little bit of rain coming through. High in the mid-60s and a low in the mid-50s on Monday night. So this is that weekend. This is that weekend that you go apple picking. This is that weekend you rake the leaves. This is that weekend that you go out and do all those autumny things that you like to do.
Get all your pumpkin.
It is going to be a perfect, perfect autumn weekend. The kind of autumn weekend we dream about. Columbus Day, by the way. Man, perfect. Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
If you like Columbus Day, you're going to love Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Nice.
You got 3 days of it coming up. Get out there and make the most of it. It is WMFO Medford. It is The Big Picture. Hey, you can find us online on Facebook. We're on the Facebooks, you know.
Mm-hmm. Everybody, give us a like.
Everybody loves the Facebooks. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/bigpicturewmfo. And stick around at 9 o'clock for On the Tell Mikey D. But when we come back, did you hear all the other things that caught our attention this past week? Right here on WMFO Medford.
I'm Sarah Beck for the U.S. Department of Agriculture with the question, just how good is good? Good, the USDA's third quality grade for meat, is not as juicy and flavorful as the higher grades, prime and choice. But good is somewhat more lean, acceptably tender, and it's usually less expensive. You should cook most good grade meat with moist heat. For more information, write How to Buy Meat, Agriculture Radio, Washington, D.C., 20250.
Okay, gang. So, chances are there'll never be an emergency ever, ever again.
Mm-hmm.
But just in case, let's talk about a plan.
Okay.
So, who's going to do what? Anyone? Yeah, okay, perfect. We'll figure it out as we go. So, who is going to grab the go bag?
What's a go bag?
It is a bag we do not have that is filled with things we really, really need in an emergency.
Guess we won't have to worry about it then.
Ah, good point. So, we all know who to call if something happens then, right?
I'd have to call Jill, Devin, Melissa, Karen, and Bruce.
And I will try to call all of you, but Greg doesn't have a cell phone. Dad's phone will have a dead battery.
No doubt.
And Julie will be on the phone with Jill, Devin, Melissa, Karen, and Bruce.
Well, this is great. I am so glad that we don't have a plan.
I know.